Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
This is The Guardian.
To their credit, you won't find me saying this very often, Canavan and One Nation and Babbitt are unavowedly pro-fossil fuels, right? They love the stuff. So the Greens, congratulations, move this little thing. And who did they get on board with them? Those guys. That shows, with respect, they are wrong, and it shows their policy solution doesn't survive contact with reality.
Hello, lovely people of podcasts. Welcome to the show. You are with Catherine Murphy. I am political editor of Guardian Australia, and delightfully with me in the pod cave in Canberra this week is Chris Bowen, the Minister for Climate Change and Energy. Hello, Chris.
Here we are, Murph, in the pod cave.
Here we are. Now, Chris is in the pod cave. If you've been following the news, you'll know this is for many obvious reasons, but let's just outline them quickly before we drill into the various things we're going to get through in this chat. The government has delivered an annual statement to the Parliament about progress in terms of its climate ambitions. There's a whole bunch of reports attached to that. There was a big development in energy policy, I think, just over a week ago.
A week ago, exactly, on the, yes. At the time of recording.
Yes, which we'll get into as well. You know, one of the biggest policy shifts in this space since we tried and failed to have a carbon price to oversee a transition. Anyway, never mind. Sad stories. So that there's that, and very shortly, Chris will be on a plane flying in the direction of Dubai.
Hopefully, in that general direction.
Well, yes, it would be embarrassing if you flew in another direction for the UN-led climate talks, COP 28.
This is COP 28. That's right. Yes.
COP 28. So anyway, we're going to go through all of that over the next little bit. So let's just start with the climate statement. Let's start there. So you delivered that this week. I think candidly, you obviously listed all the policy that the government is engaged in since being elected, and it's a lot, but you also said there's more to do. The Climate Change Authority also released some independent advice, which was tabled at the same time, which was just a polite hurry up on a range of fronts. And the sort of crystallising quote, I think, in that CCA work was that we're running out of time for a prosperous transition, which is quite a clarifying thought. So we do need to hurry up, right?
Well, we've got 73 months by the time this goes to air. It'll be 72 months until 2030. So, yes, we need to really continue to have our foot on the accelerator. And this is the point I make. You know, and I understand and respect people saying, oh, you're not doing enough by 2030, but 72 months is a big lift, a big effort to get everything done that we said we will do. And, you know, you've heard me say, and I mean it, it's ambitious but achievable. No point being ambitious and not achievable. No point being achievable but not ambitious. So you're right. Today we put out, one, the climate change statement, two, the climate change authority advice, three, the projections and forecasts and national inventory of the last quarter and the last year. So a whole bunch of very, you know, important information out transparently today for all to see. Now, what the projections show is that we're now on track with government policy for 42% emissions reduction by 2030. So it was under the previous government, their target was 26 to 28. They said we were getting to 30. With our statement last year, with the policies we put in place until then, it lifted to 40, and now today it lifts to 42, which is edging close to 43, you know, but I'm not complacent about it. There's still a lot of things that have to happen, but I'd take 42 over 30 any day of the week. But it's a big lift. I mean, for example, I know we'll talk about renewable energy. But when we came to office, renewable energy was 33% of our grid. We're taking it to 82% in 7 years. It's a big job and a big lift. And yes, in this entire transition, Murph, across the entire decarbonisation of the economy, and I, as you know, you and I have talked about it several times, many times, I see it very much as an economic opportunity for our country. But the idea that it's all going to go linear and smoothly and everything's, you know, it's going to be a straight line, that just doesn't survive contact with reality. Mm. It's a big job with big obstacles to overcome and at the same time, massive opportunities.
Yeah, and we'll get into both. You reach or you release the projections, emissions projections, and what's happened over the last 12 months. You're right, obviously on track nearly to the target, but also emissions rose over the last 12 months. Mm. Now, there are entirely valid reasons why that's the case.
Post-COVID mainly, yes.
Yeah, we all fly on planes and, you know, do other things now. But, you know, you're sort of repeating this idea that it's all a big lift, which is right, and sort of can, I think listeners can engage with that concept. You've got to move fast, you know.
Yeah.
You've got to accelerate and quickly. But it sort of, it underscores, like, the rise in emissions over the last 12 months does underscore the step change problem, right? It's sort of like there's a big, big task to basically retool the economy substantially, as you say, in what would you say?
72 months. 72 months, which is how, that's how I like to think about it, because it concentrates your mind about how big the lift is and how fast the job has to be. And I don't disagree with you. Yes. Now, emissions are up because of post-COVID, mainly because of transport, 0.8%, mainly because of transport, people moving around more, both in cars and particularly aeroplanes, up substantially. And, you know, you don't want to get emissions down by reduced economic activity. You want to get emissions down by more efficient carbon emissions with increasing economic activity. That's the whole objective of all our policies. But yeah, look, out very transparently, but you know, the projections out today, which are done by my department, are very, very clear. You know, emissions reduction is up. You know, edging closer, as I said, to 43. I've always said 43 is a floor, not a ceiling. But at the same time, I don't pretend it's easy to get to 43, because it isn't.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the issue. Like, there are many components of getting to 43.
Correct, and especially when you're starting in 2022, Murph. Yes. I mean, if we were starting in 2019 or 2016 or 2013, you know, you give yourself a much bigger runway.
Yeah.
But starting in 2022 with an eight-year plan to 2030, you're starting very late. You are the kid who forgot to study for the exam and you're pulling an all-nighter.
Yeah.
To get a good result.
No, that's right. That's right. So let's sort of think about a couple of things. Getting the sort of step change required in order to meet the target, we're going to need a transport strategy, for example. Are we ever going to see a fuel efficiency standard?
Yes, and more than that,
before we're all dead?
Yes. You'll see it more than that. You'll see a fuel efficiency standard. We've said we'll do one. I mean, that in itself is a big move by a government. Remember, Josh Frydenberg said he'd do it. It lasted from his morning press conference to lunchtime.
Well, but I'm asking this actually, you know, in good faith, because I have seen many governments promise me a fuel efficiency standard and not one has turned up.
Well, the previous government promised it on one or two occasions, but the right wing of their party killed it within hours.
Well, we started with John Howard.
Yeah, you know, all that. And of course, I mean, the United States has had one since the 1970s.
Yes, exactly. So where is it?
Murph, you might, I mean, I think people would understand that emissions from Australian cars would be higher than European cars. People would understand that 40% higher, but also 20% higher than United States cars.
Yes.
I mean, that shows how bad our fleet is. Look, Catherine King and I have, one, been doing a lot of work on it. It's actually very detailed work. We've done a lot of modelling and analysis and design work. And secondly, we made a rather large announcement last week, the biggest investment in renewable energy.
I mean,
you know, we do sort of one announcement at a time.
Yeah,
We don't announce the biggest investment in renewable energy on Thursday and announce, you know, fuel efficiencies on Friday.
I'll take you back to the Climate Change Authority, say we're running out of time for a prosperous transition.
Transport is very important. That's why we're committed to doing a fuel efficiency standard. Mm. It's also important we get it right. It's important we get it right. We've got to get it through the Parliament.
Yes.
And we have to see it sensibly implemented, right? So a range of, you know, I can just tell you, a huge amount of work has gone into the fuel efficiency standards, as I think will be self-evident when Catherine and I release them.
Which is?
Well, we will release them when they're ready.
Doesn't sound like this year, though, does it?
Well, it's not that far away, Catherine, but we are – We have been working on it and we'll continue to work on it.
Okay, let's go back to energy and what happened there with the expansion of the capacity investment scheme. As I said at the top, one of the biggest moves in energy policy for a decade, because there's a very big conceptual call there, which is there's a big transition that has to happen. Taxpayers have to underwrite it in the energy market in order to achieve, you know, the desire of increasing renewables and storage and all of that sort of stuff, right? So just sort of bookmarking that conceptual call that you've made, that's why it's a big deal.
Yes.
Now, you've got a phalanx of interest groups, most of which are utterly respectable in terms of the arguments that they're making, pointing out at the moment that Australia is not winning the global race for capital. We've got, and you said as much in your climate statement, well, you didn't say it as bluntly as I'm about to,
but you sort of did.
Right? We've got the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States. We've got favourable incentives in Britain. We've got favourable incentives in Canada, in Japan. These are massive, massive programs that are sucking in capital from all around the world. Basically, you know, all kinds of respectable people are saying the government has to make the same conceptual call that it's made in the energy sector across the whole transition, that we're not going to get this done unless taxpayers underwrite the transition in various ways, either, you know, production tax credits or, you know, de-risking investments by private capital or whatever, right? Do you accept that you have got to make the same call right across the transition in various, you know, various sectors?
I see it slightly differently, Murph, with respect, and let me run through why. We can perhaps come back to energy because I fundamentally, you know, you're right, a big intervention in energy last week, and that was because we're, in my words, doing well but not well enough.
Yep.
We needed to see the big pipeline of renewable energy investment in Australia, which there is a huge pipeline. Come back to that. We need to see it turn into final investment decision.
Yeah, but investment had fallen off, though. That's part of the problem.
Well, you want to do electricity now and then come back to the broader.
Yes.
So the chief executives and chairs of all the big renewable energy investors around the world been through my office at some point during the last 12 months.
Yep.
They all say, you are now the key marker for us or in the top three. You know, you pass your Climate Change Act, we get your government. You clearly want us to come and invest. The last guys didn't. We're here. And a big pipeline. You know, we can run through the various indicators of the pipeline. There's a huge pipeline of renewable energy investment. Wasn't happening quickly enough, not getting the final investment decision fast enough, and not getting through the planning system quickly enough. So all the impetus of the announcement we made last week is to change that, to really get it through. And that is to say, to maybe explain to the listeners what actually we did announce last week. The capacity investment scheme is an auction where we will say to 32 gigawatts, which is what we need, to the investors, what's your minimum return you need? You know, what's the baseline profit you need? And what's the maximum over and above which you'll share with the taxpayer?
Yep.
So we're really giving them a really stable and certain middle ground to say, well, we can invest in Australia. We know for absolute certain we're going to make between X and X. This is now a deeply welcoming and stable policy environment for us to invest in. And they will now bid into the auction. Now, we did a pilot just to, you know, check our assumptions.
Yeah.
I and Penny Sharp, the New South Wales Minister, released the auction the day before I announced the big expansion. That added more than a gigawatt. So we expected a bit under a gigawatt. We got such good bids, we could add more than a gigawatt, which is more than the previous government put in 9 years, in one auction. So now we're going to take that and put that across the board. And also, importantly, a lot of people sort of didn't focus on the next part of the announcement. Of those 32 gigawatts, 18 gigawatts we're holding. Now, we're going to fund it all. It's all Commonwealth underwritten, but 18 gigawatts we are holding to say to the states, come with us.
Yes.
Because what we don't want to do, and I've said this very bluntly to the states, and you know, I've got a great relationship with every one of the state energy ministers, but said bluntly, listen, we're not going to come in and underwrite all these gigawatts to see them, you know, stuck in a state planning system.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we want to work hand in glove.
Yeah.
So we're going to enter and we want to work with them on reliability because we've got to keep a reliable
we need a strategic
underneath
reserve.
And that's a strategic reserve, which is really excess energy, like have a redundancy of excess energy you can call upon in a crisis. We don't have that at the moment, hence, you know, last winter, for example. So it's really getting what is goodwill around the energy minister's table, and there's huge goodwill between the state and territory energy ministers and myself, and formalising that in agreements to really supercharge this transition. Because as I said, I think there were plenty of indicators we're doing well, Like, you know, AEMO approved 6.8 gigawatts of connections last financial year, up from 4.2 the financial year before. That's good because connections is a forward indicator.
Sure,
right? Connections
but they also said it wasn't moving fast enough.
Yeah, but no, I agree. That's why we've done what we've done. We didn't do it for, you know, giggles.
Lols.
We did it because really it was taking the policy mechanism we already had in place, the capacity investment scheme, and really saying, well, this is working, so let's just do it properly and underpin the law. And that's it. And hence the state and territory ministers have responded. Now, let's move to your broader point, because I think, Murph, I think what you were really getting at in that sort of commentary and question to me was, I think, about renewable energy-related manufacturing and supply chain and the whole IRA response, right? So that's not so much decarbonisation of our system. That's more playing our role in the global decarbonisation. And, yes, we've said we've got more to do there. We've got Hydrogen Head Start, which was a deposit, a down payment, as we work through how we more broadly respond. Hydrogen Head Start, we decided, was the key urgent priority because, to be frank, we were already seeing hydrogen investment either walking out the door or threatening to walk out the door to the United States.
Yeah.
We weren't going to let that happen. So we said, well, hydrogen is the urgent part. Hydrogen Head Start is to support green hydrogen through a, you know, effectively a bidding system and an auction, so we get the best bids to say, well, we want to develop green hydrogen in Australia. It's had huge interest from the sector, so that shows me that we've got the design right.
Yep.
And we'll be making further announcements very soon.
Isn't that excellent? Because I was going to ask you about that specifically. So obviously you've been working up responses, sort of, you know, how do we keep capital in Australia responses given the international climate? You know, it is said around the traps that Hydrogen Head Start, you know, could be expanded and that model applied to other industries or sectors of the transition. This is often said, but hasn't turned up yet. Is this right?
Well, what we have said, the PM, the Treasurer, Ed Husic and me, and Madeleine King in her space, is we have more to do on the IRA response. I mean, you know, whether you call it renewable superpower plan or IRA response or whatever it is, because it is an IRA response, but it's not just that, because Europe's done it, India's done it, Japan's done it, Canada's done it. We want to make more renewable energy in Australia. That's what we were talking about before, but we want to make more of the things that make renewable energy in Australia as well. So, yes, we will have a broader IRA response as well, but Hydrogen Head Start, well, again, Murph, we're pushing policy out the door at a rapid rate.
Sure. But when is this policy coming?
It again, is coming quite soon, but I'm not making it on your podcast today.
How soon?
Quite soon, but I'm not making it on your podcast today.
We continue
Christmas is, can I just say, Murph, Christmas is a bit of an arbitrary deadline.
Sure,
like, the world doesn't stop on December 27.
No.
You can announce, we will. I've got more announcements to make this year. We've got more announcements to make next year. It is a constant, effort.
Yes, this conveyor belt.
Of good ideas.
Fine. Just stick a pin in that for a second. I asked for that. That's fine. But let's just track back, though, because, if the response is to the sort of general conundrum that we're talking about, that we've got to keep capital in the country and capital is at risk of walking out the door and heading elsewhere because of incentives elsewhere, you know, the government can sort of sail forth and say, well, we've done energy. Here's, you know, a supercharged hydrogen head start and accompanying pick your sector, you know, wherever else that we're going to support. But then you'll still have people saying, well, that's fine, but we actually need the government to, partner in transmission investment.
And we're doing that.
Yes, but there's all kinds of regulatory nightmare, all of that. And there will be, again, respectable people who will say, well, we'll put billions into this if we get a more favourable environment. There will be respectable people who say, we will help you develop a sustainable aviation sector if we get a production credit.
Yeah.
Like, so you're answering me, but not.
No. Well, I'm telling you, I agree there's more to do on the whole renewable manufacturing space, future made in Australia in the renewable space.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm telling you again, a huge amount of work has been done on that between me and senior colleagues.
I accept that.
And but we are not announcing today. You know, I've today put out the climate statement and all the associated multitudes of documents. Last week, the biggest investment in renewable energy in Australian history.
I'm not suggesting you're on the banana lounge, but I bring you back to the Climate Change Authority saying that we are running out of time for a prosperous transition. This is why I am pushing this.
And I'm the one who you know, if my staff hear me say the number of months to 2030 again at any point, they're likely to put a pin in their eye because it's my constant reminder to the system. We have to move fast, and we are. Now, to your broader point about, well, electricity is a third of, roughly, third of the emissions, and electricity emissions are coming down, and they'll go down a lot faster with 82%. It's not the only reason to 82%. Reliability is a big problem as well, which our policy is fixing as well. Happy to come back to that. But to move on, we also have said we've got a 2035 target.
Yes.
To announce.
Exactly. We've got a proper, that coming?
We've got a proper net zero. Well, that doesn't have to be until February 2025, but, you know.
I'm semi-joking now.
Well, yes. Why isn't that out tomorrow, Ms. Murph? And then we've got the 2050 plan. Australia has a 2050 plan at the moment. Mm. It's a joke. Mm. It pains me to say. That was the Scott Morrison scamflet.
I remember it.
Yes, we were there. Saw that movie. That was the Scott Morrison scamflet, so that we've said we are ripping that up and doing a new one of those. Mm. And to underpin all that are six sector plans.
Yes.
And the sector plans weren't my idea. They were really industry investors' idea.
Yeah.
Multiple investors coming to me saying, look, we really need to know what your plan is, what you think the decarbonisation pathway for industry is, resources is, transport is. And I tested that with them and said, well, hang on, you know, you're the one with billions of dollars in your pocket. This will be, you know, government investment will be important, but private sector investment will be more important. Why do you need this? And they said, we really need to know what you think is the pathway so we know how to cater our investments. So, okay. That's what we're doing. And, you know, that work is well underway. We've put out the agriculture sort of consultation. And obviously we talked about a big element in the transport plan. I'm co-writing them with each of my ministerial colleagues, consulting with the states and territories on the way. Huge conveyor belt of policy coming there as well.
Yes.
So, you know, it's all happening.
Mm, certainly is. That's why you're in the pod cave. Let's think about COP now, because sadly we could do this for an hour, but we can't because you're busy. You're about to head off. Now, you've done a bit of signalling pre-jumping on the aircraft about Australia's positions in the broad mix of issues that will be before this particular COP. You've said a couple of times now that Australia will support stronger mitigation language. Mm. Now, I gather there's a couple of proposals doing the rounds. There is one proposal that calls for a phase out of fossil fuels, and there is another that calls out for a phase out of unabated fossil fuels. Which does Australia support?
Well, let's see. I support a strengthening of mitigation efforts around the world. The one call that we have had, the only official call, obviously there's a lot of discussions. I'm talking to all my ministerial counterparts around the world, late night, you know, middle of the night Teams meetings, which are a lot of fun when you're the Australian climate minister in the lead up to a big climate conference. That's perfectly fine. That's the system we work in. At this point, the only official sort of proposal is the COP president's call for a tripling of renewable energy and a doubling of energy efficiency, which we strongly support.
Yep, both of those.
That we, and I don't know whether the COP will agree to that.
Yeah.
Because to be frank, Murph, we go into this COP in a very challenging geopolitical environment.
Of course,
right? You could say that the Middle East and Ukraine have got nothing to do with climate, but they don't help the sort of general zeitgeist of international cooperation now.
Of course.
And the G20 energy ministers and climate ministers meetings were disappointing, failures. And I said so at the time, you know, and I said in my contribution at G20, guys, if we keep doing this, we're gonna fail at COP. We've got to get our act together. Mm. Now, until I arrive in Dubai and sit down with my ministerial colleagues and say, right, what are the concrete, that we are not yet at that stage, but I will be backing sensible strengthening of the global efforts, and we'll see what coalition emerges internationally in good company, but we'll be in that good company, you know. Unlike previous arrangements where Australia was in very bad company, blocking efforts, I'll be in there.
Yeah, we're out of
working
the Nordic
for a
corner.
Sensible outcome.
Yes.
Get consensus across the board. Because that's what the COP president will need. COPs work on consensus for right or for wrong.
Yes,
and you've got to have consensus.
Mostly for wrong, to be clear.
But you'd have to have consensus to break the consensus model, so that's going to be difficult.
Sure.
So, you know, I'm in constant contact with the COP president himself and with other ministers, But at this point, there's no sort of, well, let's strengthen the language this way or that way on mitigation. But we'll be in there arguing for a very sensible strengthening.
I had thought that we were supporting the unabated phase out of unabated fossil fuels, but you're just saying you can't go there.
Well, no, I'm saying I would support I would support certainly a strengthening in that direction, as we did in the PIF.
Yeah.
You know, and the G7, which we're not part of, they've gone down that road, but obviously, you know, we're supportive of those sort of general efforts. But I'm saying until I get there and sit down with the COP president and with – I chair the umbrella group. So the umbrella group is – we have – you know, the COP works in groupings.
Yes.
And we're in the umbrella group for want of a better word, sort of those who don't fit into other groups like Europe. And I chair that group of ministers. So that's Australia, the United States, United Kingdom, United Kingdom used to be in the European group. I invited them into the umbrella group. This is their first COP in with us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Australia, United States, New Zealand, Canada, Ukraine, Israel, Norway. Mm. So quite a group.
Interesting.
And I intend to be quite an active chair of the umbrella group. But that obviously means, as chair of the umbrella group, bringing other countries with us.
Yes,
and it's not just about
sensibility, yes.
And it's not just about mitigation. That is my number one priority, frankly, but also there's loss and damage. There's the global stocktake. There's global finance of climate action. There's the adaptation pledges. This is actually a very busy COP agenda.
It is.
And we'll be sort of coordinating with what we call like-mindeds to maximise the impact. So I'm not here saying, well, what we're going to argue for is this full stop and that comma.
Yeah.
I'm saying the direction of travel that I'm supporting is a strengthening language. I also said at Lowy Institute, laid down some markers about what we think about loss and damage.
Yes.
More than happy to talk about that because I know that's very important to people as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, we want to see progress there, but we want to see progress for our region. I don't want a model which doesn't work for the Pacific.
Yeah, you want a Pacific-centred landing point on all of that. And interestingly, you also want, you know, the Gulf states and China to actually do more.
Yeah, well,
climate finance.
Yeah, my point
good luck with
that. Well, you know, I may or may not succeed. but I don't think it's a – I think it's appropriate to point out, just for listeners who haven't followed this closely, in 1992, the world agreed on a thing called common but differentiated responsibility.
It did.
Which is all very well and important and still valid, right, which is we all have a responsibility – which is common, but it's different for developed countries and developing countries.
Depending on economic circumstances.
But in 1992, they sort of said, well, this is the list of developed countries and this is the list of developing countries. Yeah. And guess what? The world has changed.
Yes, the annex does require
an
update.
But the list is set in concrete.
Mm, isn't that funny?
And I make the point, one, this is not about sort of getting Australia to do less. This is about getting more into the pie, into the pot.
Maximising resources.
And also, frankly, in all communities, to bring society with us. So, you know, because the, you know, people who will find any reason to complain about anything international in this building will say, look, you know, you're doing this, but China's not putting any money in, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, to ensure that we have strong community support, I think it is appropriate for Australia to say, yes, we're up for, you know, we were on the transition committee for loss and damage discussions. We have been very active in promoting a good outcome.
Yeah.
I've been consulting closely with Pacific ministers about what they want and need. But, you know, also let's not just pretend that we can keep everything in stone from 1992.
Yeah, but it's sort of interesting. I am being a bit sceptical about whether that balance will ever shift.
I'm not suggesting that I'm going to waltz into Dubai and change it, saying I don't have a problem with saying, hey, guys, this can't go on forever like this.
No, I know you're not saying that, but it is actually intriguing with the sort of rapprochements recently between our own Prime Minister and the Chinese leadership and also Joe Biden, that both countries are saying climate change is an opportunity, obviously, for joint enterprise between bilaterally and also with the rest of the world. So it'd be kind of interesting.
And it is.
Really,
and this is, you know, my comments about the 1992 annex are not just about China. Yes, China is obviously included in that conversation, but, you know, it is a broader conversation as well.
Yeah. Okay. We're on the clock. So let's quickly, obviously Australia aspires to host our own COP with the Pacific in, is it 2026?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. So do we expect any concrete movement forward on that front in Dubai? First question. Second question, related though and important.
Yes.
You've been saying in this whole conversation we've got policy coming out the wazoo, and obviously that means the bureaucracy is very stretched, obviously trying to do this jumpstart operation, right? Like just looking, observing it. There's a lot of effort required. COPs are huge things, massive things. Now, I understand sort of geostrategically why Australia thought it'd be a good idea to host one. But that's like a sinkhole of resources. No, well, I don't mean that. Sorry, I don't mean that pejoratively, but it'll be a massive undertaking. So do you still think it's a good idea, given how much policy you actually have to crack on with?
I still think it's important for Australia. I think it's an important indicator that Australia has returned to the international realm of leadership, that we're even frankly regarded as a serious candidate. You know, win or lose, we wouldn't have been regarded as a serious candidate 3 years ago. Not that the previous government would have even bothered to bid, because, you know, we would have been laughed out of the room. Mm-hmm. I've learnt a fair bit in this process. It's a bit like, you know, white smoke emerges and it's pretty opaque as to what happens up until that point. Sure. Even when you're a candidate, there's no sort of hard and fast process. Yes. And in fact, the world has not yet agreed on who's hosting next year's COP, in 2026.
Well, that's a complication, though, isn't it?
And that'll be something that is already being.
Is there some Eastern European?
Yeah, there's issues. So that's sort of, and then the year after technically hasn't been resolved, although most sensible people think that will be Brazil, because that's the natural sort of
way of things.
So that's more so 2027, or sorry, 2025 is more certain than 2024 in terms of where the COP will be, our bid has been for 2026.
Yes.
So this is all caught up in that little vortex of international negotiations, which I expect there'll be further discussions on.
But it's not, may not move in a concrete direction.
Correct, yes.
And still no regrets about actually taking this on.
Look, I still think it's an important opportunity, particularly for the Pacific. I mean, when else can the Pacific, regardless of, you know, having the COP president being of the Pacific, i.e. In Australia, working closely with the Pacific, I can't think of a better way of getting their issues highlighted on the agenda, because I've got to tell you, they're not enough. You know, we all think about the Pacific and talk about the Pacific here in our conversations in Australia and our region.
Yeah.
When I go to these meetings, they're not front of mind, to be honest, until I and we raise them. And this is a great opportunity to have them elevated more.
Okay. Let's just quickly now, because you're massively on the clock, we spoke about fossil fuels, and I understand why you won't front run a process that Australia is chairing in terms of specifying what language that we'll support. So just talking about domestic politics just quickly, obviously the Greens in terms of left politics are getting quite a lot of purchase around, you know, no more fossil fuel projects. It's a very simple cut-through message that aligns with the science, where a lot of the stuff associated with the transition now is highly technocratic for, you know, utterly reasonable reasons. Recently, the WA Premier Roger Cook said WA emissions going up would be good for the planet because, and this is
not quite.
I'll finish the sentence, because it will lead to a dramatic reduction in global emissions. Right, he's basically saying if we sell more gas, then emissions come down because, you know, countries all of a sudden say, oh yeah, well I'll get off coal and I'll buy gas. What is the evidence point for this?
No, I don't think that's what he was saying, Murph. To be fair, I think he was saying. No, because I was there. I think the point he was making is Western Australia can help the world decarbonise through critical minerals and other things.
Right.
And getting them out of the ground is not without cost for emissions.
Sure.
And there will be emissions as they get the critical minerals out of the ground.
You don't think it related to gas?
With gas, he was saying, and by the way, I say, to be clear, in an Australian context, you see, there's some people say, oh, look, gas is no lower emissions than coal. Well, let me say this. I'm not going to argue about, you know, when it's burning.
Well, it's methane.
When it's burning. I'll tell you this. When gas isn't being burnt, there's zero emissions.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a coal-fired power station on, it's burning emissions, whether you need the energy or not.
Yeah.
The one thing about coal is it's not flexible. The one thing about gas is it's flexible.
Yes.
Okay, so this is the big virtue of gas for domestic energy production.
Yep.
It is highly flexible. So you're not burning one iota during the day when we've got plenty of energy. That's what we call peaking and firming. Perhaps, you know, we need to do more to explain what peaking and firming actually is. It's turning a power station on when you need it, when you've run out of renewables, in effect, right?
Yep.
It's a very important underpinning of the energy system.
Sure.
And now, I used to say, well, you can turn a gas-fired power station off and on with 15 minutes notice. It's now basically 2 minutes notice with some technological improvements. That's very handy as you're moving to 82% renewables to have that in backup. And the other point is gas use is declining in Australia. That's, you know, that's partly a result of government policies, but production is declining faster. Hence, there's a gap in 2026 and 2027. We don't have enough gas in 2026, 2027. Hence, we brought down the gas code to say we want, you know, it's complicated, but we want, if you're going to do new gas, you want an exemption, it's got to go in the domestic market because we've got to fill that gap. Now, the Greens don't have an answer to that, frankly. They just don't. You know, they say, oh, no new gas. Well, how are they going to keep the gas-fired power stations running in 2026? I'll tell you what they say. They say, well, rip up the export contracts. Well, there's a thing called the Constitution, sorry. You know, the Commonwealth cannot just come in and rip up a contract that is contracted to export. What we can do is say we want new supply focused on domestic. And then the other thing they say is we'll just electrify everything. Well, we are doing that. But even with our electrification policies and Victorian government's efforts and everybody else's, even with gas use coming down, we still have a gap in 2026, 2027. So you're right. It's quite a nice little neat little slogan. I don't deny that.
Well,
it's not a policy which survives contact with reality if you are managing a complicated economic transition like we are and ensuring reliability as you do so.
I've paid that point, but it is more than a slogan, in fairness. It is a call that aligns with climate
science.
Well,
I think, though, if the Greens were here on this podcast and you asked them, well, hang on, AEMO and the ACCC said there's a shortfall in 2027 and 2026, and that's very bad for Australia not to have enough gas for, one, our gas-fired power stations, and two, those industries, which one day will use green hydrogen, and no one's more forward-leaning than green hydrogen about green hydrogen than me in this building. We ain't here yet, and, you know, we are going to need gas for things like fertilisers and plastics and cement in the meantime. We don't have enough gas for them in 2026, 2027 without some tough calls. The Greens don't have an answer to that. If they say we'll rip up the contracts, they need to explain how they'll deal with the Constitution and the potential hundreds of millions or billions of dollars of compensation that would be required. I don't think they'd be too keen to pay those to the gas companies.
Sure. I mean, you're right on the complexity of the issue, but nonetheless, it's a cut through position and it aligns with climate science, and it is causing Labor trouble on left flank.
I understand it's a simple argument, but here again, I mean, I'll say this, Murph. You know, the Greens moved to disallow that gas code this week. I warned that this would be a problem, and that, you know, it's a bit of gas regulation. They say they don't like the gas companies. They voted. They actually moved to rip up the regulation on the gas companies. And, you know, I said that's a mistake. They moved it. Who walked in and voted with them? Matt Canavan, One Nation, and
that other
Babbitt,
fellow.
Ralph Babbitt,
yes.
from the Palmer United Party.
Yes.
I mean, look around and see the company you keep. They voted to rip up the gas code because to their credit, you won't find me saying this very often, Canavan and One Nation and Babbitt are unavowedly pro-fossil fuels,
yes.
Right? They love the stuff.
They are consistent.
So the Greens, congratulations, moved this little thing. And who did they get on board with them? Those guys. That shows, with respect, they are wrong, and it shows their policy solution doesn't survive contact with reality.
Okay. Well, anyway, we could go on for another half an hour, but you can't. I probably can't either, sadly. Anyway, thank you for your time, Chris. I appreciate it. Obviously, we will be glued to Adam Morton's tremendous coverage out of COP because our climate and environment editor will be with you over in Dubai shortly. So anyway, we will hang on all of those developments. Thank you for making time in a really busy last week. Thank you to you guys for listening. The episode this week was produced by Phoebe McElraith. The executive producer is Molly Glassie. The end.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghigher education. This message was paid for by EY.